open the Senate Revenue Committee. Today we have three bills up. We're going to do our Senate bill first because
we like to accommodate Mazin here. Has a busy schedule and we try to accommodate. Sometimes we like to accommodate Mazin's busy schedule and sometimes we accommodate.
I don't have busy schedules.
Paul, who has the food who's doing the food processors?
So we'll do 479 first.
And if I could get a copy of the schedule, Barbara.
So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 479. Mary, do you want to refresh us on just what the bill does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will. The Senate Bill 429, I have a dash 2 amendment to it because the dash 2 amendment changes the original bill that was heard as a proposed income tax credit, and it changes it to a proposed property tax exemption. It provides a 5-year property tax exemption for purchases of new equipment by qualified companies. The qualified companies must be operating in one or more of the following industries as defined by National American Industry Classification System. These are numbers developed by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. They're replacements for what you might have heard before as SIC, Standard Industrial Codes. And they pertain to the beet sugar manufacturing industry, the frozen fruit juice and vegetable manufacturing, frozen specialty food manufacturing, and fruit and vegetable canning. The original bill, which is not in front of us, dealt with a larger set of NAIC industries. Okay. The background on this is that on March 18th, representatives of the food processing industry reported to the Senate Economic and Business Development Committee that certain sectors of Oregon's food processing industry have experienced a major decline in employment due to an inability to compete globally because of the price of labor abroad is substantially lower than the hourly wage paid to workers in the U.S. Consolidation within the food and fruit processing sector also reduced Oregon producers' market power with respect to setting as opposed to accepting competitive wholesale prices with respect to selling their products. Based on these changes, over the past 3 years, employment in the vegetable and fruit processing sectors has declined about 15%, and payroll has declined about 11%. According to a representative of the food processing sector who highlighted his rationale for the committee at the March 18th committee meeting, the Senate bill will build a partnership with government that will enable Oregon's food processing industry to compete more effectively in a consolidated global market. Based on value-added comparisons, the food and food processing sector is Oregon's third largest manufacturer, ranked just under the high-tech industry and the forestry industry.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Questions for Mary?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you. I'm kind of just glancing through here, and I haven't had a chance to actually digest everything that's before us, but it appears that there's going to be somewhat of an offset based on the improvements that are brought in, meaning new capital equipment, in lieu of paying a portion of the property tax. Is it equal dollar for dollar, or is it a percentage?
No, I read it as being a property tax exemption on the purchase of on the value of those particular. It's a 5-year exemption on the value of new equipment. So it's not on all their equipment, such as that used for replacement. And I had to estimate what percentage of the value of purchases in Oregon by those sectors would have been like new.
Suspect if only the equipment, new equipment.
Yes, it's new equipment. It would be that such as conveyor belts, equipment that...
But this is purchased from effective date of the act forward, not...
Retroactively? Correct. Yeah. Correct, Mr. Representative Stein. I mean, Senator Stein.
He was a Representative Stein.
No.
We all were Representative Stein.
you're saying.
Yeah.
Although we're glad we're not now, or two of us are. Let's go with Ken Yates and Katie Koba. And Joan, you're welcome to join this panel if you'd like to. It's always my goal to get Joan back up to testify. I'm 0 for like 10. I'm 0 for 11, it looks like.
She is much more charming than I am, Mr. Chairman.
I agree with that. So, committee, just before we let Mr. Yates and Ms. Koba, the governor's office has been working with the food processors on the Dash 2s, I believe, and my intention, we scheduled it for a work session today. I have it rescheduled for Tuesday of next week, and at that point I would like to move a bill. And we have three options before us, the Dash 2s, the original bill, or the Dash 1s, which are a slimmed-down version of the original. And I'd like one of those to move next Tuesday, and with that I'll hand it over to the governor's office in Ms. Koba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, director of the Department of Agriculture. You are correct in that the administration has been working with the food processors to try to craft a bill that we think can really target a specific sector of the food processing industry here in Oregon, which is tied very closely to agricultural production in the state and a sector that's frankly been struggling through the last quite a few years. I just want to put on the record, we don't take the notion of moving from an income tax credit to a property tax exemption lightly, and I know that local government representatives have concerns about that, and we've had some conversations with them and intend to continue to have conversations with them on this topic. But in contemplating how best to assist the food processing industry, one of the challenges that we have is in dealing with the tax code, it gets difficult to really target a specific sector of an industry and assist it. The challenges that we saw with an income tax credit is that it assists those companies that are actually making money. And we were concerned that it wouldn't help those companies that we're really trying to target, particularly in the fruit and vegetable processing area as well as seafood, that are struggling and perhaps not actually recording income here in the last few years. In addition, the challenges, I think, for the industry, as you've heard in your previous hearings, in terms of dealing with global competition and particularly here in Oregon with high wage rates, trying to incentivize the industry to invest in new technology, we believe, is the way we're going to continue to keep this industry viable in Oregon and competing in the global marketplace. We're going to have to invest in equipment and new technology to stay ahead of our competitors, whether they be elsewhere in the U.S. or, frankly, foreign countries. So with that kind of a slate in the conversations that we were having, we felt really it would be more beneficial to the targeted areas that we're trying to help to provide a property tax exemption for those specific areas of food processing on new investments in equipment so that they can continue to be competitive in a global market. We understand your time frame. We had hoped to have the new amendments in front of you today. I think we can easily have those before you in time for next Tuesday, as well as have a chance to share those with all of the various constituencies that are interested in those amendments.
Great. So Tuesday's a fair date for
us. Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
New amendments, not something besides the Dash 2s?
We're still working and refining based on conversations with experts at the Department of Revenue as well as Legislative Revenue Office. So it's going to be pretty similar to what you've got in terms of property tax exemption for particular targeted food processors, but we've got some more detailed kinds of questions in terms of what if a food processor is already in an existing enterprise zone. We don't intend this to be 5 years on top of the exemption they're already getting. It would run concurrently. So some cleanup language like that that we believe we need to put in the amendments.
So the Dash 2 at this point is not quite ready to go.
That's correct.
Okay.
And we always like to have at some point a sunset on, so at least it comes back to us at some point and we take a look at how it's working, So we'd want to see some sort of sunset on the bill,
okay.
Given a fair period of time for it, since it's a five-year property tax exemption.
We can do that.
Right. Mr. Yates.
Mr. Chairman, Ken Yates, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Northwest Food Processors Association. I'm pleased to be here with Director Koba, representing the administration, and myself representing the industry regarding the two tax bills that you have been considering. And I would like to take a moment, in a few moments, to talk about 365 and some ideas that we've developed to help that move along. These dash two amendments were just handed to me. We need to digest those and to refine them, working with the administration and your staff, Mr. Chairman. I think we can get there and take into consideration some concerns. We've already looked at some of the NAICS codes that could be eliminated, maybe others that should be added. There's some questions regarding coverage, and we want to make sure this is as specific and as targeted at the distressed sectors in the industry as possible. I'm not interested in expending my credibility before you and asking for help for those who don't need it. We are really wanting to make this as targeted and as specific to the distressed sectors as possible. The game here is to compete globally in a marketplace that has great overcapacity due to globalization and consolidated customer base. And the only way we're going to compete as a state in this critical industry is through technology investments, innovation, new products, investments in our workforce. This legislation would free up capital. There's several ways to do that, and we're working with you and with the administration to bring a proposal that you can adopt. With that, I can answer any questions, but I'd like to have a few moments, if I could indulge your patience on Senate Bill 365 as well.
Any questions on 479 before? It's a bill we're pretty well acquainted with, at least the rationale for it. Great. And Senator Beyer, if you want to come on up, and I'll let Ms. Yates go on Senate Bill 365.
Right, and I'll defer to the Senator. I won't take long. Senator, good to see you. Regarding Senate Bill 365, again, we think we can eliminate two or three of the NICS codes. For instance, sugar beet manufacturing. The last sugar beet plant announced its closure just recently in NISA, so we can close the barn door. The critter's gotten away from us there. Also, there are one or two others that I think we can probably skinny out here because they are largely covered by other tax incentives. Under the definition of seasonal labor in Section 2, subsection C, there's been concerns raised about the length of hours. I think it works out to be roughly 6 months.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
I apologize. We're talking about another bill. My only concern is there's nothing on the agenda, and I'm trying to figure out what the purpose is. I just want to make sure, one, I don't have the bill here to even know what we're talking about personally. The other thing is I'm just concerned that we're doing something that's been publicly noticed properly if we're taking stuff in that we're considering.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think it's fine. We don't have 365 out, so we don't have the bill in front of us.
Okay.
But I feel fine allowing Mr. Yates.
Senate Bill 365, it's the other bill that was heard a week or two ago by this committee. I'm just throwing out some ideas, Senator Przemski, just for your consideration. We'll follow up with staff.
My only concern is procedural.
I understand.
I don't have something here. I'm more than glad to listen to what you got to have, but one, I'm not here because I don't have the bill in front of me. And two, if we're actually doing something, then we're going to need to allow, I think, in the public process, if someone else wants to get comment, to be able to do that too.
Sure. And let me just conclude by saying I think we can skinny down that seasonal labor definition and also the percentage in that bill of the tax credit and move this thing off center. And we're prepared to talk to staff and lay the groundwork for your consideration.
And Senator Brzezinski, we're really busy, but one of the germane issues is that 479 and 365 are of the same nature.
Okay. I just don't have
income and property tax
to,
and stuff.
To grasp what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, they are very similar in nature.
Okay.
Of income tax credits, and so, but that we will give it a full hearing if that bill becomes a vehicle. Anything else, Ms. Yates, that you wanted to add to?
No, I think I'll cede the rest of my time to the gentleman from Malala. Thank you.
The gentleman from Malala.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Byer, State Senator, District 9. Here to comment on Senate Bill 479. Senate Bill 479 and Senate Bill 365 were both drafted at my request. They both deal with the food processing industry. Senate Bill 479 was then introduced by this committee, and I appreciate the chair for introducing this bill. Senate Bill 365, as Mr. Yates talked about, was introduced by myself. But they both deal, and they're both relating to taxation, so in fact we could combine them to make a single bill out of them if this committee chose to do so. But they both deal with tax credits for a certain segment of our economy that is very crucial, especially in my part of the state. The food processing industry has been one of the major employers in my region of the state for years and years. And very recently, because of the global economy and other things you have heard already testify to, we've seen a sharp decline in this industry. And these bills recognize that we need this industry, and if we don't do something, we're going to lose it. And that's what the attempt is with both of these bills, to be looked at either individually or in aggregate. It doesn't matter to me if one bill passes or the other, both of them pass, but we need to do something to make sure that we don't lose this vital industry. And the reason this industry, by my perspective, is so vital, not only because the jobs it is created by this industry, but we have a land use system in the state that requires people to use their agricultural land for certain things. They have to produce agricultural crops. They can't do other things with the land. Of course, now we have Measure 37, which the committee I'm a member of is debating right now in a room upstairs. But even with that, if we have this industry leave the state, we're going to have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of acres of land that is zoned agricultural use only, that the people who own it and farm it are going to have no crop they can produce on it and make money. And that is what's crucial, because if you lose one segment of the economy when you talk about agriculture, it forces the people into something else. And you'd soon overload that segment of the agriculture production, and then you force a decline, if not elimination, of that sector also. So without the food processing industry here to support our farmers, we are going to create a snowball effect, and we've already seen it in my district, or my former district. The city of Woodburn lost two manufacturing plants very recently in the last 4 years. The city of Salem has lost many processing plants. The city of Eugene has lost processing plants. We just heard, I wasn't aware of NISA losing the last beet manufacturing plant. This is crucial, and the time is crucial for this industry. We have a global economy. We all know that you can go to the grocery store and buy fruit from Chile or fruit from Argentina or fruit from New Zealand at virtually any time of the year, or vegetables or nuts or anything else. Because of this industry has struggled to try to meet that demand of the changing economy. And these bills are here to recognize that and recognize that they need to do two things. We need to compete on a labor. That's what Senate Bill 365 is talking about, is the cost of labor in this state in order to compete globally. Senate Bill 479 is the recognition that we need to upgrade our processing facilities in order to compete globally, because most of these places where these products are produced outside of Oregon, especially in the third world countries, they are more modern than we are now in their technology and their plants, because they have very recently been installed. So our plants here are trying to catch up in a time when the prices they receive are below cost of production. That is an impossible scenario for an industry to survive in. So that is why we brought these two bills forward. I encourage the committee to work one, both, or combine them into a single bill. I'm glad to hear that the industry and Department of Agriculture is working to refine them, to make them so they are targeted. We're not, as Mr. Yates, I think, said, we're not out looking to give people a hand that don't need a hand. We're trying to protect an industry that is vital to the state and is very much hurting. I'd be happy to answer any questions about either bill or the combination of the ideas that are in the bills, but just here thanking you for the hearing and hopefully urging you to do a work session very soon, Mr. Chairman and members.
Questions for Senator Roger Byer? Thank you. Anything else from the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gail, do you want to,
Fred, are you in? Yeah, you're in here. Cities and counties, y'all want to talk or not? We created a little aisleway there.
It's nice how they redesigned it.
It's nice.
Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I guess at this stage, I appreciate that we have till next Tuesday. I think I've shared this with Kate, with Director Koba, that when the investment became a local investment, we would have appreciated being part of the discussion. We've been referring to these as mystery amendments. This is the first time we've seen them, and we understand the need. We'd like to sharpen the focus, and I appreciate Ken Yates's comments about that. Also, it'd be useful to know where these facilities are and if they're already in enterprise zones, and some other details that we need not bore you with, but we appreciate now having an opportunity to actually converse about this since we're providing much of the incentive. So we appreciate that.
So you'll be included in the information in terms of where the facilities are and what counties would be affected and cities would be affected. You'll be included. The Food Processing Council has that, and I believe the Agriculture Department probably has that readily available.
And we might have some other, Mr. Chair, some other ideas to add to this that maybe will be helpful too. So
great. The only thing, and I know I've said it, is Tuesday we do want to, this will move out of our committee. So we're getting late in the game. Ms. Deister.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I guess I would just echo Gil's comments. And, you know, obviously, as has been stated, their communities do have some incentive-type programs such as E-Zones. And, you know, that is their effort to help industries such as these. And we would be interested in seeing where these folks are located and how that is or is not working for them. So.
Great. Great. Thank you very much. Any questions for the cities or counties? You can ask about urban renewal if you want to.
That is a topic that we need. It's not on the schedule that we need to talk about.
Okay. Let's. Anyone else? Since we have no amendments on Senate Bill 479. Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Katie, for all the work. Appreciate it, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 479. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2197. Hazen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2197A goes now. The last session in the 2003 session through House Bill 2267, the legislature instituted the state transient lodging tax, also known as the hotel motel tax. And what that did is basically blanket 1% on lodging expenses. That bill also allowed the existing local taxes to be grandfathered in, so they stayed as they were. However, it prefaced any new taxes in the local or in the state level to have a targeted expenditure after they're collected to be in the promotion of tourism in the state, and basically channeled through tourism agencies. For the state tax, we have the Oregon Tourism Commission that utilizes the revenues that come from the tax and allows for promotion of tourism on Oregon in general. Now, the bill in front of you, House Bill 2197, is trying to remedy, obviously, some either an omission or clarify for the statutes a segment of the law that was not very clear. When the Department of Revenue, who collects this tax, started the process, it became obvious that there are certain types of rooms or lodging that was not completely covered inclusively in the law. And that was on the advice of the Attorney General, where the vacation homes, vacation condominiums, and so on were not included to be collecting the tax. So it started at the beginning. I remember there was some kind of confusion, and some providers were sending the tax when they shouldn't, and it was returned to them, versus others who were not. And it started creating certain levels of inequities. I think this bill tries to extend the blanket on top of the bed, if you will, and include these new, well, not new, that was supposedly the intention of the bill, reintroduce that, and also introduce the campsites and tent places and so on. This bill went through amendments in the House to exempt non-profit organizations and campsites of youth and churches and so on, that actually and conference centers that operate on a non-profit status. Now, up to today, we have the collection, not up to today, but up to February, it was day then when we started this process. The department have collected about $8.21 million up to February of 2005. And what we were looking at in the 2003 session, we were thinking about $22.5 million a biennium. This is the 8.21 looks like it probably will fall a little short of that. The 16.5 million original estimate, however, once this bill is introduced and it goes through the process, it will be applying against $815 million universe, if you will, of room sales. About 50% of those is in the Portland and Willamette Valley area, and this bill would probably introduce for this session. If it's enacted, it will start in January, so it'll introduce an additional $345,000 in 05-07. It will bring in about $507,000.
Mazen, why are we so short in terms of what we thought we were going to receive and what we're actually raising on the 1%.
Mr. Chair, I think first the start of the program, start of any program, this is a new vehicle, new program, new tax for the state. So once it started rolling, it took time to really establish and put the mechanism in place and notify providers and give them a chance and time to comply with the new taxation. So I think that beginning and that difficulty in any beginning program have contributed. And then there is this elapsed time where things take time to be processed and sent and so on. Now, the base, it seems, is still there. There's about, as I was mentioning, the estimates are there's about $815 million in sales, room sales, that is, in Oregon and the state in general. So if everything is operating perfectly or good enough, since I don't think the estimate would probably need to be revised. But I think we wouldn't be on line two in 07, 05, 07, and then 07, 09 to get to where we think.
So we are recalculating down on 07, 09?
Not at this point, Mr. Chair. We think that we will get to it in 07, 09, what we were thinking, but this will give it a full biennium. The 07, 09 will be the first biennium, probably, to have a full implementation period with a program and an apparatus of collection that is fully functioning and well understood by businesses and providers and so on.
Okay. Questions for Mazin?
Todd Davison and Oregon football fan Scott West. Did you guys coordinate your suits for
you would think we would you slide over just a little bit? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Davidson, and I have the privilege and pleasure of serving as the director of the Oregon Tourism Commission. I would like to reconcile the estimate comments and questions that were made a little bit earlier. With all due respect to the good folks over at the Department of Revenue, when they initially put some information on their website, they were looking at, quote, total accommodation sales in the state when they arrived at that $11 million figure. That figure, though, that total accommodation sales figure, includes all local lodging taxes and a number of other things that are collected that are not subject to the 1% statewide lodging tax. It's an estimate of travel spending in Oregon. So it's actually an erroneous estimate. And we had always spoken to the legislature when we were working on House Bill 2267 during the 2003 session that we anticipated that the 1% statewide lodging tax would generate between $7.5 and $8 million a year. We are at $8.1 million, as Mazin duly noted. So we are on target. We're not running $3 million under where we anticipated we would be. We're actually nailing the estimate that we provided to the legislature in the 2003 session. So we will certainly work with the folks at Department of Revenue and in the Legislative Revenue Office to help adjust that estimate and those figures as we do move forward. As Mr. Malik noted, during the last legislative session, we brought about the passage of the Oregon Tourism Investment Proposal, which, among other things, implemented the 1% statewide lodging tax. And that tax commenced on January 1 of 2004, and first revenues were received by the Oregon Tourism Commission in June of 2004. So we've got about 10 months under our belt with the new revenue source being utilized. The revenue from the statewide lodging tax is continuously appropriated to the Tourism Commission to carry out their statewide tourism marketing programs and implement regional cooperative marketing programs as well. Specifically to the legislation, House Bill 2197, the A engrossed version that you have in front of you, is a technical fix to House Bill 2267. There were definitional issues in using the word designed rather than the word used when we were talking about vacation rentals specifically. And an attorney general's opinion to the Department of Revenue advised them that they wouldn't be able to really enforce the collection on vacation rentals and vacation homes because of that definitional problem. So to ensure that we have equity in the system, this legislation is necessary. In addition, the legislation also incorporates exemptions that have been previously adopted by the Department of Revenue in their administrative rules. For example, church camps, health facilities, health care facilities, mental health facilities, and others are all provided clear exemptions, which in the past had been in administrative rules, but now we're putting them in statute as well. So this legislation helps clarify the definitions and the exemptions, and that's the intent of House Bill 2197. Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Davidson. Do y'all have an accounting of where the initial appropriation has been spent, and I guess examples of, I'm sure you could get them to us, of if you've done it, the advertising that you've done, and
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do. In fact, I could provide the committee with our budget and our marketing plan for 2004-2005, which is the first year, the second half of this biennium, obviously, that we're currently in, but the first year that was predominantly funded with the 1% statewide lodging tax, and it would be my pleasure to provide you that.
That'd be great. And not obviously not the, if you have a the thinner version of...
The top line executive summary? My pleasure. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Davidson?
I got a question.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
I'm just curious, on page 3, line 7, this is under the exemptions, where it says a dwelling unit that is leased or otherwise occupied by the same person for a consecutive period of 30 days or more. I mean, it looked like you're trying to just get into people who, you know, generally renting houses aren't the ones that are... but if someone took a vacation and actually rented the motel or the hotel for 30 days, would they then... Does that mean they're exempt if they happen to take a month-long vacation at Sun River? They wouldn't be charged that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, members of the committee, in application, that is correct. That's also consistent with the way many local lodging taxes are collected, not only in this state but in several other states as well, that after 30 days, you're no longer subject to necessarily and considered transient lodging. You now actually can fall under landlord-tenant agreements, and Scott is far more proficient in those areas than I am and may want to actually add to that, but that is why that exemption is specifically spelled out in statute.
Most of us don't get 30-day vacations here, but I mean...
Or have the ability to take them all at one time if we do,
yeah.
Right?
All right. So is it problematic to make it like 32 days or 31 days? Maybe we'll...
Mr. Chair, yes. We believe it's consistent along the 30-day issue. We get into considerations around landlord-tenant law that I think, frankly, these delineations have been very clear for a long time, and they're pretty well embedded in local statute, and that's why it's mirrored in state statute. And we believe it's the appropriate it's the appropriate vehicle, and it should stay that way. Yes.
Do you want anything else, or is that...
good bill should pass. We think it's a, you know, we support it. We think 2267 was, you know, 99% right. We think that, again, the exemption that we're, or the technical fix we're addressing today was something that we believe was covered within the statutory language last time, and we found out it wasn't. And so this is our, we're working with all the parties, Department of Revenue and all, to fix that, and we believe it's the appropriate fix, and we'd encourage your support today.
Scott, we didn't get your name.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Scott West with the Oregon Lodging Association.
Great. Any other questions for Mr. Davidson, Mr. West? Prediction on the upcoming season?
Mr. Chair, Ducks 8-3.
I like that. 9-2.
And the Beavers?
Mr. Chair, I will defer to someone way more knowledgeable of Oregon State football.
Thank you very much. Dave, do y'all want to, y'all have anything on this? Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2197. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2469. Elizabeth.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, with House Bill 2469, we're beginning estate taxes. And I know we haven't really had an orientation or anything on estate taxes, but this is our first bill. And so I'll just kind of refer you first. I gave you the 2005 Oregon Public Finance Basic Facts, the estate tax section again, just to make sure everybody has it. And it does kind of give you a nice overview there of kind of the history recently. And I'll just highlight page F2 there, where we're talking about the different federal legislation and what we connected to last session, since we had a big bill and lots of discussion last session. But basically, in 2003, with House Bill 3072, we basically clarified where we were connected under federal law, and it went back retroactively and allowed then estates to have the assumption that was made by the Department of Revenue so that there weren't amended returns that were needed. But basically, going forward, what House Bill 3072 said was that we were going to be connecting with the federal legislation of 1997, which is the taxpayer Taxpayer Relief Act. And that Taxpayer Relief Act in 1997 did increase the gross estate value filing threshold, and it was $600,000 up to $1 million by tax year 2006. So you can see there that it's gradually going up. Right now in 2005, we're at a gross estate filing threshold of $950,000. So basically what that's meaning is that all estates that are less, if their gross value is less than $950,000, then they do not pay any tax in the state of Oregon. Now, the issue is that in federal law, they also enacted the 2001 Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act. Now, that act has different filing thresholds than the 97 law, as well as some other changes. But Oregon is not connected with that 2001 federal law. So basically, say in 2005, then you can see in the middle of the page there that gross estate value filing threshold in federal law is now at $1.5 million. So in 2005, then, you've got this discrepancy for estates between the filing threshold at the federal level versus how much they have to pay in Oregon. So estates that are greater than $950,000 but less than $1.5 million, they aren't paying a federal estate tax, but they are paying an Oregon estate tax. So that is where some of the confusion has come about, and that's what really this bill is trying to do with House Bill 2469. It's really dealing with this discrepancy now that we have in current law between the federal estate filing threshold and our 97 estate filing threshold that we're connected to here in Oregon under that 97 federal legislation. So basically, Oregon in 2005, as I was saying, is that there's a difference in between the $950,000 and the $1.5 million. And then 2006, we will be at $1 million. The feds will be at $2 million. And then through 2008, we'll be at this $1 million difference. And then in 2009, the Fed goes up to $3.5 million as far as the gross filing threshold, and then we have a difference of $2.5 million. So as you can see, this would grow. And also, this issue deals with any other changes and differences that there may be in federal law versus Oregon law with the state filing threshold in the future. So this really does try to deal with this difference between Oregon and federal in the future, given any changes that might go on at the federal level. So last session in House Bill 3072, there was a provision there to allow surviving spouses to make an election for Oregon's estate tax that was different than the election they would make at the federal level when the first spouse dies. But under current law, Oregon's qualified terminal interest property, the QTIP, election may be made only if income distributions are mandatory and the taxpayers pay for their attorneys to redraft their wills or trusts. And also a personal representative cannot make a different election on the amount of the trust that will be qualified for the marital deduction under current law. So basically with House Bill 2469, it allows the taxable estate value for Oregon estate tax purposes to be reduced by the value of all of the Oregon special marital property in the estate. So it's broadening the definition of Oregon's special marital property to include then trust with some discretionary income distribution. It allows an executor of the estate to elect the amount of trust that will qualify for the marital deduction so that people aren't going to have to pay for attorneys to make these changes for them. It's going to specify the requirements and forms that will be necessary to qualify property as Oregon's special marital property. It clarifies that upon the death of the surviving spouse, that the value of that Oregon special marital property will be included in the gross estate tax, and then it will have a estate tax assessed on it. It allows these amended estate tax returns to be made for deaths occurring on or after January 1st, 2002 and before the effective date of this 2005 Act for those elections that are dealing with the specifics in this legislation. It specifies that if a refund is paid as a result of amended estate tax return pertaining to a change in the Oregon special marital election, the refund does not need to be paid with interest unless the refund is made on or after March 2007. So it's basically giving the Department of Revenue time to make these refunds. And it takes effect 90 days after the end of the legislative session. So basically, as far as the revenue impact, there isn't really any revenue impact. But, you know, I just wrote up a little description to help you understand that basically under current law, some taxpayers can make special marital elections for their Oregon estate tax purposes that are different from the federal marital elections, but there are some restrictions. So this is basically eliminating those restrictions. And so for certain types of trusts, the taxpayer may be paying additional attorney fees for changing those wills and trusts in order to make the special marital deduction in Oregon different from the federal election. And again, this is all due to now our difference in our estate tax filing thresholds at the federal level versus Oregon's. So basically, this act is really designed to make it easier for taxpayers to make the special marital election. The overall impact of this act is indeterminate. In the upcoming biennium, the Department of Revenue may have to make some refunds, but it's bound to be real small because there's probably not that many people who really paid attorneys and stuff to have their trust changed, which then they would could go back and have these change. So it is anticipated that there are only going to be a small number of estates who will be receiving a refund, but in the long term, there really is no revenue loss to the state general fund because the states will be paying this Oregon estate tax after the death of that surviving spouse. So it's just the timing of when we're collecting that revenue.
Questions for Elizabeth? Thank you for that good background. Questions for Ms. Carrie Schoenfeld and Mr. Mark Huglin. Hope I pronounced your... Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Deckert and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schoenfeld. I am the chair of the state tax section of the Oregon State Bar, as well as a member of the board of directors of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and I'm here representing both organizations. I guess I'll get us started and just give you a very brief overview. We felt that there was a problem when we disconnected with the inheritance tax last legislative session because we did have individuals where at the death of the first spouse they were having to pay estate taxes, and as their wills and trusts had been drafted, they did not expect that. They expected they would be able to defer the tax. We got together with the task force section of all estate planning attorneys and a lot of accountants and looked at what could we best do without creating any additional tax to the state of Oregon to try to fix the problem. And this is what we came up with, what we call our Q-tip fix. And so really all that it's trying to do is defer the tax to the second death. The way that trusts and wills have been drafted usually take advantage of the federal exemption and have not addressed the state exemption, and that's the reason that we now have a problem that most trusts and wills are drafted such that a taxpayer may have to pay tax at the death of the first person that they're not expecting to, expecting they would still have those funds available for the survivor's health care, wouldn't have to sell a farm, timber property, or something that is caught up in that because their estate exceeds the exemption amount. And so I think it's pretty simple fix, but we think that it would really help those taxpayers who would not have to go back and have their trust and wills drafted. So we say that this is an unemployment provision for attorneys so that they don't have to go back to their attorney.
And Ms. Schoenfeld, do you have a listing of who was in that work group?
I can get you one.
If you have it.
Okay.
In my meeting with your guys' representatives, I got it, but it seemed like a good collection of CPAs, estate attorneys, and folks from our Department of Revenue?
Yes, Department of Revenue Assistant Chief.
Great.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, my name is Mark Huglin. I'm the Secretary of the Tax Section of the Oregon State Bar. And I'd just like to add a few things that Carrie had mentioned. First of all, the policy issues involved here typically at the federal and state level have always been to defer the estate tax that's owed until the death of the surviving spouse. And that's one of the benefits of this bill. It will allow that to occur. I think the other thing to keep in mind when we're talking about some of the revenue impact here is that it's still possible, even if this bill were not passed, that the personal representative can go into court. It would be a costly way to do it, but have a trust reformed. Right, currently under current law, it would be allowed. But it is costly and timely and kind of a waste of resources, both from the tax, the taxpayer, the court system, and the only one that benefits there would be the lawyers. So anyway, this bill kind of just helps that and just make it so that it's not necessary now. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify a couple of things. The purpose of the bill is to defer whatever taxes owed on the death of the first spouse to the death of the second spouse. Is that correct?
Yes. Representative Brzezinski, the way that the federal law works is that it's set aside in a trust, and to the extent the surviving spouse does not need that fund, then it is taxed at the second death. So if it was diminished because the surviving spouse needed it, then the tax may be less, which is what kind of has historically been. But otherwise, yes, it would be taxed at the second death.
Right. And if I could follow up with the understanding that it can be, that the money is placed in trust and can be used, it sounds like exclusively for the needs of the surviving spouse. Can there be any distributions from that trust to other, either family members or other individuals?
No, and that is part of the requirements that and the reason for this bill. A lot of trusts have been drafted because under federal law, they set aside the federal exemption that would qualify, and then the balance went into a trust that would qualify and could have only income distributions. And in order to qualify as a Q-tip trust and defer tax to the second death, it can be only income distributions and only to the spouse. So this bill does that to any trust that doesn't already qualify. If you elect, you can cut off the right of anyone other than a spouse to take distributions if all of the children so elect, and then no distributions can be made during that lifetime except to the spouse.
And one other question, Mr. Chair, regarding the unemployment of attorneys. Can you go over that for me? Just because what I thought I was hearing is that what it says in the summary is under current law, you can actually have attorney fees paid. And as I just want clarification for myself, if not for the record, how that works.
If no changes are made, and under current law, an awful lot of trusts and wills out there at the death of the first person, they would have to pay taxes. They can easily go to their attorney and have it modified so that it would work under our current exemption amount so that you could defer taxes. I think that's what we're trying to prevent, is, and we're concerned that a lot of taxpayers don't know that they need to go back and have a change. And so without this bill, those taxpayers that weren't aware, and we figure the very wealthy ones are going to be more aware and go back, but those that didn't would be stuck either paying tax at the first death or, as Mark said, having to go to court to remedy the problem.
Okay. And so what this bill would do would be keep them from going back to modifying the
language of the trust.
I was going to say the trust, but I figured it's not the trust. It's actually...
It can be in a will or a trust, but yes, it would prevent them from needing to go back to purchase that change.
And is under current law, is it set up where if they do go back, that the attorney fees for making that change can be reimbursed out of the trust?
Generally, attorney's fees for estate planning is not. If it's tax planning, it is deductible from an income tax standpoint. So it depends on how you classify it.
Work, so
you're glad.
Yeah. It's a conflict of interest on this. So what, you're sure, Mr. Hugelin, that if you wanted to go to court, you would be successful.
Well,
and it's just the mechanics of working your way through and getting on the docket. And
Chair Deckard, you can go into court and try to get the will or the trust reformed. Now, to do that, you're going to need all of the beneficiaries and everyone involved to agree to that. Even in with our current bill, you're still going to need that. But you know, and for minor beneficiaries, you would need what they call guardian ad litem appointed for some of those beneficiaries. And it just would be a huge potential nightmare with a large family to do that. And but they can go in. I have not personally gone in and had a trust reformed to try to do
this, but you're probably several thousand dollars for just at least just in attorney's fees, and then just the burden on the court also.
Mm-hmm. But there would be no incentive. I'm trying to think why the family wouldn't all want to do it. I mean, there would just be unless the fees were just so exorbitant that you would just
right. I mean,
we'll pay the tax.
Or you could have. And even under our bill, it wouldn't fix the problem. You could have just one person that just decides that is, I mean, in the family just doesn't want to cooperate.
I'm sure that. Other questions or thoughts for this panel? Well, thank you for helping perfect the law that we passed. That's our positive way of putting. Anyone else on House Bill 2469? Are folks comfortable?
I have one question for staff,
please.
Since this came from the House, do we know what the vote what count was on that?
55 zip, I think I saw.
He's good. He knows there.
Must be in here somewhere.
The House
55 ayes, 5 excused.
Got it. Thank you.
Proposition. Are folks comfortable moving this bill?
Yeah.
The floor. It seems like a good housekeeping, if that's a fair description.
Taking care of those
spouses. That's right. Close public hearing on House Bill 2469. Open a work session on House Bill 2469. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2469 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2469 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections to that motion? So ordered. Would you like to carry the making our inheritance laws?
I'd love to do that.
Great. Senator Starr will carry that. We'll close that work session. And our next meeting will be Friday. We'll have the House rep with us. So we get to go way down to that end. There's a lot more of them than us. But we'll meet here.
I can't think what happened at the end.
Yeah, Paul, let's work on that. Our committee had me down, outside that window out there.
I think seniority should be recognized in Friday's meeting, Mr. Warren.
Also a reminder, though,
we're meeting at, 8:30 to receive the revenue forecast.
Friday
the
13th.
Wonderful.
Yes.
I'll bring my black cat. Bring your black cat. With that, so we'll see everyone at 8:30 on Friday for the revenue forecast, and we stand adjourned.
Tomorrow or Thursday.